So we were both invited to be part of this group of business people. And they have meetings in 10 different cities in Europe. And we sat next to each other in this first lunch. And you started telling me about your career and your stories. And I immediately thought, okay, there's a guy that I think can inspire other people to move their ass. Because you seem to move your ass quite a lot.
Yeah, I like that. I can't sit still. I think we came from living 6 years in Australia, in Sydney, and we were looking for a similar climate, which is, it never gets below zero, it's generally warm, nice weather, less rain and less grey skies than in Holland. So we thought we'd try it here. And we still, we did a sort of a bit of a sidekick back to Holland to see whether we would still like it. But no, it is at the end of Spain where we're going to stay.
But you had been here on vacation and you had this memory of...
No. It's Marlene's, my wife's sister, that already moved here a year or something, or even longer before us. And then another sister went here. And then we said, no, we might as well go and see if we like it too. And we went first to Portugal, then to Madrid in summer. It was far too hot. And I like to live close to the sea, so we ended up in Altea.
Right. So Altea was your first stop?
No, we started off in Portugal. And Portugal, Madrid, and then Altea. And then we moved back to Holland because I had to finish a job there. And then, of a project. And then we moved here.
And you told me that your sister-in-law lives in Portugal.
Yes, she moved recently to Portugal. Yeah.
I'm curious to know how do you prefer Spain over Portugal?
Well, it's Portugal is sort of like what Spain is like. That's more or less what they are saying. What Spain is like was like 20 years ago, or even longer. It's very primitive opposed to where we live now. And well, like we joined the club, the GBO club, not for nothing. It's just that we still want something going on. If you don't want that anymore, yeah, you can go and live in Altea and not do anything. Or you can go and live in Portugal, yeah, for that matter. But no, I like what's going on here, being close to at least an airport where you can easily go somewhere and close to big cities where you can just spend the day and there's something going on.
Right.
Always something needs to be something going on in my
life. Yeah, that I could see that. That's why I asked you to give me this the pleasure of this conversation today, because when I sat next to you, so for people who don't know, GBO is Global Business Owners. So we were both invited to be part of this group of business people. And they have meetings in 10 different cities in Europe. And we sat next to each other in this first lunch. And you started telling me about your career and your stories. And I immediately thought, okay, there's a guy that I think can inspire other people to move their ass. Because you seem to move your ass quite a lot.
Yeah, I like that. I can't sit still, that's right.
And I loved it that you started your, when you sent me the your introduction, you said, I'm 61 years young.
True, that's the way I feel it.
That's great. That's a great, yeah, I'm going to start saying I'm 43 years young. Makes much more sense than old. So how come you've been selling air for 25 years?
It originated in Australia when I was sort of, we were more or less going to leave there, and my last job there is in, I headed an interior design department on an architectural company, And I was looking for two people to replace myself because they needed someone that could design and organize. And I could do both. So I quickly found the designer, but I couldn't find the project manager that's in me, let's say. And I my last project there was designing offices for handicapped people, but actually do more than just the interior design, but also do the, like, you know, think of how they, with their handicap, they can do the work like anyone. So I did a lot of one-to-one sort of things, designs with people, and that worked out very well. Then I came to, we moved here to Spain after I did a project in Holland. We moved to Spain and I set up a company because there was a lot of foreigners coming to Spain at that time that went in early retirement. Like, they didn't wait till 65 or something, so they came when they were 60. By the time they became, and their kids, they left their kids behind, like for example in Holland or Scandinavia or whatever. And then they were in need. They bought all these nice houses, but then these houses were all have stairs, and they wanted, you know, they couldn't climb stairs anymore, and they wanted a ramp, and instead of having a bathtub, they wanted a shower. And well, that was all peanuts for me. And so we were selling actually the technical aids to go with it. If people wanted a wheelchair, we would sell them the wheelchair, things like that. Boards and pretty boring stuff, but very needed. And
you were selling, but you were based then in Holland?
In Altea. No, we were already here.
Oh, you were already
here. And but it's the foreigners that came to live in Altea where I discovered their problem.
Okay.
And then I thought, like, okay, I was doing these houses, turned the bathroom, took the bath out, put the shower in, and then I got to know dentists, doctors. I did their, houses, or first their clinics, after that their houses. And at some stage, at Saturday night, the doctor called me and he said, like, do you do oxygen too? I said, oxygen? Yeah, four. Well, we've got a client that just came here to Benidorm, and there was supposed to be oxygen arranged for this person. And it was in the middle of the night, and I said, like, listen, of 11 o'clock Saturday night, I said, well, it's a tricky one, but I can see what I can do. I arranged it, but that was in the time of the pesetas. So what happened, these people didn't know us, we didn't know them. The guy on the truck would actually go to the patient or client and say, like, okay, here it is, and now you've got to pay, like, 40,000 pesetas in deposit so that you don't knock the machine off. And these people go, hey, what? No, I don't have that money. I have only guilders. I don't have pesetas. Well, said the guy, I can't leave the equipment then. He said, yeah, but then I need to go to the hospital. He said, yeah, well, big deal. You know, it's not my sort of thing, but the whole hospital is more expensive and whatever. So they gave him something as a deposit. I don't know what. And that actually triggered an idea on organizing it in a different way. I thought, like, if there is, like, more people that are in need for oxygen that are traveling, then how do people go about that? And that's where I actually started looking into it. I actually went to Holland to the company that sent this first patient client. I asked them how they were doing. They said, yeah, we would love to see more people going to Spain. They ask us for it, but we don't know how to organize because we don't speak Spanish. And they want deposits in pesetas, and those people don't have that money with them, and blah, blah, blah. So I said, okay, we're going to do a new different. Started talking to the Spanish supplier, locally in Benidorm, in Alicante was at the time. And I said to him, like, okay, this is the situation. How can we do this? We guarantee for the bond, let's say, so people don't have to pay the deposit, and we want you to do the delivery. So they did, and then gradually we build out this business. By that time, my sister-in-law came to work with me. We build out the company, who actually transformed it from selling technical aids to only arranging medical oxygen worldwide. that started, of course, of first in Spain, only on the tourist area, so on the coast. And later on, we took it to, they were asking us for other countries like Portugal and what have you. So bit by bit, we got further away and further away. And currently we're, I don't know, between, there's an average of, let's say, 80 countries a year, I think. And we probably can provide up to 120 countries where we could be active at the moment if necessary. So
right. So you're not producing the equipment. You're just being commissioned to.
We're actually only
to distribute.
We're like, you can compare us with a travel agent. They don't have the plane. They don't have the hotel. We don't have a plane, a hotel. We don't even have oxygen equipment, except for in Dubai, because that's a different law there. We have there. We do have our own depot, but for the rest of it, we actually use local suppliers. They're not used to what we do, so they generally they get paid by the local government. They supply to people. They don't see invoices. It all goes, you know, somewhere. But we so we went around, my sister-in-law and I, we went around the world to visit people where we thought, like, suppliers where there was demand, where people really wanted to go and spend their holidays. So we would go there, make the, you know, the arrangements, and start sending them people from that moment. So that's more or less how it works.
That's great. So 25 years selling air to those in need.
Yeah, that's it.
That's, have you noticed that in the 25 years that you've been doing this, the price of air has gone up a lot?
Yeah, it well, there's a couple of, there's quite a few things actually that have changed our business. It's not so much because the price of the air goes up, because oxygen is expensive, but it really depends on where you go. Let's say that you want to go to Turkey, it's incredibly expensive. But if you go to, let's say, the south of Spain, it's not that bad. So if people say, like, that's too expensive for me in that area, haven't you got an option somewhere else? We could probably offer them another place. But there is more to that. It's not, it's these days that people can actually buy, we've for a few years sold ourselves, portable oxygen equipment. So that means that you buy, which is expensive, it's like 3,000-5,000 euros, you buy a certain device that you charge with power, and then it, you can be up, and depends on how much oxygen you actually need, you could be up for 4, 5, 6 hours or 24 hours outside, as long as you keep charging the battery while you're in a hotel or in a restaurant or in your car. So people that travel frequently and could get away with it. It depends on how many liters a minute you need, how many hours a day. It's a complex business. It's not, therefore there's no one else that does it, because it's too complex. I could be telling you days how it works, but it's not gonna stick to your mind, and only unless you really need oxygen, you probably wanna know the ins and the outs of it.
No, I'm more curious about the, well, two things. First, I want to understand a little bit about the medical oxygen vest. I thought that was interesting. And I think that's what you're talking about when you say portable.
Yeah, that's, I've always thought that oxygen actually should come out of your clothes. And then you might say, like, so what do you mean by that? You know how all these guys on these skateboards, they have everything in their jacket. Their phone is built in, and their solar panels on their back and God knows what. And music and everything is in there. And I thought, like, why don't we just design a vest which is like a body warmer, type of body warmer, where within the vest, the actual, everything is concealed, like all the parts of the portable oxygen. All you've got to do is to put on the vest, and like people that play golf, for example, and that need one, because otherwise you have this machine hanging on your hip, which is not very handy. So vest would be, I think would be a great idea. So we did a bit of a study on that, and we made a 3D video of it. And we had people approaching whether us for if it was already for sale, but we didn't see it through, because you first need to take a patent on it before you can actually do that. And that, beside the money, I think that something like this is copied very quickly in China or something like that. So I didn't really see much of a future in that. So it's just one of those things that you then let go and move on to the next step.
Yeah. You would still like to see it though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wouldn't mind if someone would even, you know, he doesn't have to pay for it. If he would just take it and make it work, because I know that there's a lot of people out there that would like it to have the possibility to purchase it and then just travel anywhere they like.
Right. So the other thing that I was curious about is, as a business owner, working across borders, because this business has been across borders since the beginning, how do you compare that with doing business across borders today, 25 years ago and today?
Okay, major difference is the fact that we are within the European community. Before actually the EU was invented, we had to deal with all sorts of foreign currency. So you can imagine, we had a client coming from France going to Spain. You have to give them the prices calculate everything back to front and things like that. We do that internationally, of course, today. But as the majority of our business was in Europe, it was actually, for that, it was handy to have the European Union, let's say. Beside that, it's only, it's complicated. There's nothing standard in this world, in the oxygen world. So there is not like, the patient is not standard. So you need to really find out from the patient what he's in need of, what he's used to, what he can handle, like equipment wise. And then you have to find out where the country where he's going, if that is available over there. And if it is available, within a year, it might not be available anymore because they changed the equipment, the company was taken over, because more and more, when we started, I think we had about 30 or 40 something individual suppliers, medical oxygen suppliers in Spain. Currently, there's probably only 3 or 4 big ones. They take everyone over. So the equipment changes, the people that you deal with change. So it became different world. But the most important thing, that is what our people in the day-to-day business will tell you, is that it changed from where people would ask us for oxygen for, let's say, to be 4 months or even 10 months in Spain. Now the insurance companies don't pay for that anymore. So those people have to pay themselves, or they get some part through the European community, the health insurance card. The problem there was, of currently, is that we are getting more and more complicated cases. We used to have someone just saying like, okay, I want that address in Spain, 7 months, 10 months, that type of oxygen, and it will be automatically every week, refill, blah, blah, blah. Now, today, people would say, okay, I want to go with a boat to whatever country, then I want to take the train there, and then I need to go whatever. You think of it, and they come to countries with us that Ghana, we have never been. Now we got a patient going there. So you need to set something up there, but to just for one patient, it might not be worthwhile. It changed. Every inquiry at the moment is like, now a headache, it's difficult. It's not straightforward anymore. So the people that, you know, do these sort of things, I think very highly of them, because it's so complicated. I wouldn't be able to do it myself anymore, put it that way.
You're saying that the logistics now is more complicated because of mobility, because people have more mobility nowadays and they're...
Yeah, or the demand for them I think that when we started, the possibility wasn't there. People didn't travel with oxygen, didn't exist within their own country, maybe. But generally, they weren't making big trips or something like that, because there wasn't really anyone that was doing what we are doing. And when we started doing that, it grew very quickly because people got to know of it and think like, hey, that, you know, gives me possibilities. But then it was just an in and out, like they would go to from whatever, Fiji to Paris and back home again. But now they go from Fiji to Paris, from Paris to Berlin, from Berlin to London to New York, back to Auckland, and back home again.
So now I want to change the topic a little bit, and I'm going to come back and forth. But I'm interested to know, because you know that the podcast is called Inspiring Careers, and the objective is for us to inspire other people who are looking for ways to change their careers. So I want to know, what has helped you? If you could give me an example of a moment in your life that comes to mind, or something that happened in your professional career that has sparked the biggest professional light. Something that really brought light into your professional life.
Probably the fact that my last job, like a real job where I had a boss and things like that, was working for a boss. And although it was a good guy, no problem there, you think you're employed, for example, for, let's say, 40 hours, but then you know that the work is never going to be done in 40 hours. So you start working more or less they expected from you or something, you start working 50 hours. Or maybe 55, maybe 60 hours. It's all for the boss with it, the same salary. And you start working Saturdays. And then one day I thought, like, all I do here for a boss, I could, if I put all these hours in for myself, you know, then I got to come up with something that I can do for myself, have the nerve to start for myself, take a risk, not having, you know, getting out of the box, not having a basic salary. And you got to start a sort of structure or think of something, and to come up with something. And I think that these days it's easy, far more easy than when I started, because of internet. Because if you want something today, you come to think of something easy enough, you want to sell it, you find a way through the internet. You'll find a way. You need the money. The internet is there to help you. In those days, I needed to come up with something that I'd either learned or that I had some knowledge of to be able to do. So
are you saying that what sparked this light into your professional career was the moment that you decided to go solo?
Yeah, and the other thing with that is that I had, from the beginning on, I had this vision, and I moved always, and I still do that all those years, is I had one principle that whatever business I would do or I would set up, that I should be able to monitor or manage from the Bahamas, which is a metaphor. But and every time I thought, like, okay, is this gonna set me back in an office? If so, for how long? Do I really need that? Do I want that? What is needed not to do that? So it makes you, and these days, like, you're a digital nomad yourself, you know what it's like. You want to be able to go somewhere to feel free, although you still need to work, but then it'd be handy, and it's possible these days with internet and everything, that you can just, you know. But I did that before, actually, the internet. The internet is now here 35 years around about that. So I wanted to do that before that already. That was a bit more complicated, but if you know what you want, then it's easy.
Why the Bahamas?
Well, metaphor, could have been Fiji too.
Or Spain.
Doesn't matter.
Have you ever run your business from the Bahamas?
Oh, good question. No, I haven't. But I've run it. These days it's pretty normal that you work from home, or that you're a flex worker, or how do you call it, that you're hardly ever at the office, only for meetings or something like that. We're now 25 years in the oxygen business. Only in the first 5 years, I think, we had an office. And after that, we said to everybody, okay, now you go and work from home. As long as we all work on the same platform, on the same database, and we're every day with each other in contact, there shouldn't be any problem. And these days it's very normal. Those days it was very weird. But you know, I remember in Australia, when I got there, I started off as a graphic designer. I was just sitting, I would take the door out of the hinges for my bedroom, and that I shared with many people, with other people. And I put the door on two chairs, and that was my drawing board. And that's how I started, you know. So, and at least if you don't have any like stuff, you didn't have a computer, the drawings were done by hand and everything like that. You take a pencil, you travel the world. It's like if you're a hairdresser, you take a pair of scissors and off you go. And these days companies become more complex and there's more possibilities, and then you probably need a laptop to travel and to move around. But I've been like we've been about 5 years ago, we went for around about 2.5 years to Holland. In those 2.5 years we moved, changed house three times, and I worked from my laptop, and I only came back here every 3 months to meet with my staff. Our staff, so
it actually works better, I think, when you're away.
When
you learn how to put things in automatic, things start happening without you being.
It's not so much. I mean, with us, especially with the oxygen, is a lot about trust. First of all, the people that work for you, you send home, they work from home. You need to trust them. If you would need to check them all day, that's not going to work. And the people that work for us around the world today, just to arrange the oxygen where it's supposed to be, it's all trust. Trust that when we ask them to go at that hour, that time, make sure you get the oxygen at that hotel at that day. Okay, we'll check and check and check and check, but you trust that they actually do this sort of work. And I must say that generally it works out well.
That's great. So you have the oxygen business, you paint. I saw some of your paintings in Pinterest.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
A lot of paintings against the bull fight.
I did it how do you say that? Collection on anti-bullfight paintings. That wasn't very received very well in Spain.
I bet not.
But in Holland it was, so.
Yeah. I actually heard that now in Valencia, a few weeks ago, they changed. Now they can't have bullfights here.
That's right.
Right?
It's getting better. It's getting better. But it's not just Spain. Eh? It's in Mexico. It's in India. It's in France. It's everywhere. It's terrible. But now, so I hoped that it would help to bring a bit more awareness to that issue. But like, I'm not an artist. I'm an artist. Like everything is more like what you've seen on Pinterest is more a hobby. I make lights and I make furniture. I did houses.
I loved the copper lights.
All right. Okay.
That is very, very impressive. So you create different lights of different materials. You have the paintings. You have the oxygen. You're doing an online course to help people buy real estate in Spain in a healthy way. What else?
When I came back in Spain, funny enough, a lot of people, friends from us, had already gone elsewhere or back to Holland. And I wanted to meet more people, so I set up a rowing club. Because I've seen when we were living in Amsterdam on a houseboat, like 5 years ago, I saw people coming past and rowing, and I thought, like, why don't we do that in Spain? And they have the big rowboats, like the lifesaver type of boats. And I thought there must be something else. So I set up a rowing club, funny enough, did some radio advertising, actually attracted a lot of people. And
In Altea.
I kept it for 2 years. It was more hobby than anything else. But it became a bit too risky because like the people that were coming were every week they would become elderly, more older than the ones that were there before. So at the end, I had sort of, you know, I was more or less, it became dangerous, put it that way. If they would tip over with a boat for some reason, I would be liable. And I thought, like, I've got to do away with that. So I gave up on that, but I still row myself. I still have a partner that I row with a couple of times a week. Uh-huh. And I still don't understand why not many more people do that. So several people that bought the boats are doing it, but for the rest, it's more again one of those hobbies. And you'll try things, you know. It's with the lights. It's only because I was doing paintings, and the paintings were rather big, and I could do that in Spain. But when we went to Holland for a few years, we bought a houseboat in Amsterdam, and I had a bench to work at, which was not even a square meter. So I thought, like, what am I going to make here? And then I came up the idea of making lights, because they don't take up a lot of space. But that was also, it's a hobby. It's not like that I'm, you know, doing this for the market or anything like that. If someone would ask me to design one for it, then I'll probably do. I only do one-offs. I never repeat myself, not in paintings, not in lights, nothing, interiors. And then I move on to something else. There's something else that comes to my mind, and then we'll see if we can try that.
So, I'm guessing you don't drink, don't eat chocolate. Because in my free time, I'm drinking wine, eating chocolate, and while you're creating copper lights or painting or...
Yeah, no, I drink, but I drink. I'm not a drunk, but I drink, but I don't. I eat chocolate. But
how do you find time for all of this, you know?
It's difficult. So sometimes I let things go. Currently I work with my brother-in-law on a prototype of a certain surfboard that you be able to move forward in a complete different way.
And, a surfboard?
Yeah, it's like a surfboard, but rebuilt. And so it's always something, but then there are projects that maybe, you know, we work on it once every 2 months for half a day or something like that, because we don't have the time, or I don't have the time. And then one day we'll finish it, and it's things like that. It's not like that I'm looking for time, but I've always... This masterclass has now cost me a fair bit of time, because beside my work in the oxygen business, I try to get that on the road. How do you say it?
Okay, so go ahead and tell us about that. How did that happen? Like, did you create the online course because you were basically tired of repeating yourself over and over to all these people that came to you asking for help on how to solve their...
More or less. As I've been designing houses and shops and clinics and things like that, I know a lot about the Spanish building industry. Then I've also did, beside the design, always the project management of my own designs, but also project management of other people. And
but always related to design, or of
always related to like houses, refurbishments, of renovating things.
Because
like
you're an architect,
I'm
right?
I'm in fact autodidact. But so I can't say I'm an architect because I don't have the papers, but I've designed houses, and an architect will sign my drawings because he thinks, you know, that they're good enough to sign for, to take the warranty for it, let's say.
Right.
And but so what happened was that about a year, 1.5 years ago, I thought it's a bit of a waste that all the knowledge I have, because I haven't been doing this since a burnout 14 years ago. And then I thought, like...
You had a burnout?
I had a burnout.
14 years ago?
Two burnouts. One came when I came back to my mom in Australia. I thought that I could do everything. I said to everyone, I'm going to see you next week. Someone organized a huge party for us. And I thought, like, for all old friends, I've been away for 6 years, and then I thought, like, I'm telling everyone, I'm going to be there, see you next week, and I'll see you next month. I couldn't just do it. It was too much. And then we moved to Spain. Everything went well. But then I had in the oxygen business and designing the houses and the clinics and what have you. And then all of a sudden I realized that again, that I had a big burnout, because, and I went in actually in therapy to find out what the problem was. And the problem was I couldn't say no. That was all I needed to learn, because anyone I was having all day long
it's
on two
so
phones.
It's so difficult to say no.
Yeah. And I was always on two phones, and I always wanted to make everything to a good end, or to bring it to a good end. So, you know, one phone regarding the building and the other phone regarding the oxygen. I was doing night shifts for the oxygen with trouble. The next morning I was already on the building side again. So it wasn't really, really well. It was a bit too much. So then I had to make a decision, what I'm going to do. And I said I gave up on the architectural side, of at least doing that for clients. I can better do that for myself. Do something up, sell it again that way, opposed to just working for clients, and see if I can build out. At that time we were at the Oxygen 14 years ago only active in Europe, and I thought like maybe we can make it worldwide. And then we changed our name from Care02 to Oxygen Worldwide, and we actually went worldwide. So we're now up into Australia and where have you. And
Yeah, so I just want to open a parenthesis with the learning how to say no, because I think that's very, very important. How would you recommend somebody who is having a burnout, like you did,
okay,
to start, you know, how can they know what to say no to? Is there anything, any exercise that you did with yourself to figure it out?
Well, see, I got a burnout for... while I was running things on my own. And I had my sister-in-law already working with me and some more people, but I mean, it was not like if I was working for a boss. There's a lot of people that get a burnout these days that work for a boss. And it's maybe because, you know, they want to please him too much. They're afraid of their job, losing their job if they don't do it right. They really want to get out of it, and they don't dare taking that step. So that are all sort of ingredients to end up somewhere in your bed crying and thinking, look up, what I'm going to do with my life now. Okay, so to really good advice for that is listen to yourself. Stay with yourself, not try to please all the world, because it's impossible. And try to draw, that was definitely for me something, draw the line somewhere. Like, you know, if I finish the house, for example, completely built for someone as a holiday home, and these people would only come Easter, summertime and Christmas to the house. Every time they come, they experience something. The gas bottles are empty, the car needed to go for a checkup, God knows what. And they would call me. The kids have ear infection, needed the Dutch doctor, where can they buy peanut butter, things like that. So I became a personal assistant. Well, up to a certain extent, that is fine if the people are friends and, you know, you're friendly with them and you know them still. But I had people that were really only my clients, and they still kept me calling after that, up until today, although I stopped already 14 years ago. So that is something where you can draw a line. You can say like, that's what I'm not going to do anymore. Okay, from now on, here you got all the addresses from everyone that's been involved in this. You call them yourself. But then, yeah, I don't speak Spanish. Well, learn Spanish or find someone that can
translate
for you. Yeah, okay, so we'll get a translate program from internet or something like that. But I can't just come for every peanut butter thing to your house or explain it to you. So that's where I draw a line. And actually, I gave up completely on that whole, all of that work, and concentrated myself only on the oxygen, knowing that that was still had potential to grow and was not just relying on me and gave me more freedom because I could travel. If I was doing the reform, building and doing project management things, you can't go away in the middle of a project. And if you have six problems at the same time, this is very hard to get away. And I still always the thing in the back of my mind, how do I keep myself free so I can travel and live where I want? And that was the best thing to do, just to give up on that, continue with the oxygen that everyone, you know, is same like a digital nomad, and then we'll
move
on. So
the oxygen business is the business that sets you free?
Yeah, that's the core business that gave me the possibility to move, and still, I can still do that. If I want to go and live tomorrow in Australia, I can still do that.
Work and the online course that you're about to launch is also
the online course. That's what's the question. Yeah. What the thing was is that I realized that I have so much knowledge on that building industry that I thought I'm going to put that into a business. I'm going to be, and I called myself the inspector. It was an idea of a friend from me in Australia. He said, "Why don't you do that?" Because I said I've written a book and I've lost the book due to a crash, a hard disk crash, and then I thought, like, I'm going to rewrite the book. And he said, the book is not going to get you anything, you know. Why don't you start doing surveys? He said, yeah, but I'm not a professional engineer and not a professional architect. And yeah, but the experience is enough. Go and do it. So, okay, I set up a company called The Inspector of a business. And I started taking people, these clients, potential clients that wanted to buy property in Spain. I took them by their hand and I visit all the properties they wanted to see. So you would go and see six properties with a real estate agent, the client, and the seller would probably be in the house. But soon I found out that that wasn't really, 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 like, I like to, you know, see happy people.
Everybody hated you, right?
Everybody, like the real estate didn't like me. The seller didn't like me, and actually,
even the prospect buyer didn't like you because he wanted you to say that it was okay for him to buy.
Yeah, and I took away his dream. So, and then I thought, like, oh no, I don't want all these unhappy people, and you know, although, and if they are unhappy, then I don't want to be there. So then I thought, like, I'm going to do an online masterclass, wherein I explain what the pitfalls are in buying property in Spain. Now, you can find a hell of a lot on the internet already, but the major problem was real estate agents, because they don't really have a clue on every property that there is, whether things are working or not working, or why things are the way they are.
And it's not their job.
No. So they should, therefore, I recommend people to take someone along to do the survey, to have it checked with the council, to take a translator if you don't speak the language yourself, things like that. But it's a very extensive course. I've now already worked on it for about 6 months. I hope to launch it within a month, if everything's all right. In the meantime, in the same process, I needed to write a sort of
a hand. How can people find it?
You will be able to find it on the internet. The name will be what real estate in Spain might not tell you. So I'm not saying they don't tell you, but they might not tell you. But it covers all of it. So from the beginning, from things that you might think, oh, but that's a very common sort of thing. But you probably look at the view and you forget to look at the common thing, whether there is a garbage tip next to your house. But it also goes about, you know, really sort of very, very important things about words. In Spain, you've got a word, finca. A finca could be a block of land, could also be a house. You know,
people... Everything. From I know, what you so, told I know me someone like that, all the details that somebody should know before.
Yeah. But you can't remember all that. So I put together also that you get with the class is a book, is a handbook with checklists. So if you're on the site, then you know, during a viewing of a house, you can actually see in the book, okay, I'm in the kitchen now, what should I be watching out for and why, and what do I need checked, what sort of list do I give to the real estate agent, because they're going to take you everywhere. You don't want to go everywhere. You want a house with a sea view and a swimming pool. Why should they take you to a house in the country that has no view and no swimming pool? But they do. So things like that, and it's all explained, written. There's a lot of tips, a lot of anecdotes from what I experienced myself in all those years. And in the meantime, I wrote a book only about tips, because everyone, after they build something, they're gonna do some refurbishment, either a kitchen or a bathroom or an extension or a pool. So I wrote a book about that, what is possible in Spain and what they should be aware of. So that's more.
So from now on, every time somebody calls you and says, "Oh, Rutger, can you please help me?" You're gonna say,
"Do the course."
Just do the course.
Yeah, it's the only drawback is, of course, that people will say, "Listen, you've got all the knowledge. We want you alone, like the inspector." But that's not what I'm going to do anymore. People can now gain knowledge of their own by doing the course, going to view a property. If they've done the course and they follow the book, then there is no problem whatsoever, and they know exactly who they can call and ask. And there is an enclosed community.
Maybe you can just now do some lectures. You know, you can charge much more money than you used to, and you can just say, "Okay, now for me to go, this is my ticket."
Yeah, I could, but I really, like I said before, I like to do sort of only one-offs. So I would, for example, a concept design. I wouldn't mind doing that, but I wouldn't want to go with every sort of person that has done the course and say, "Like, now come and do it and help me with the refurbishment." No, I gave up on that a long time ago. So
right.
It's going to be this, and then we'll see how this goes. And sure enough, there will be something else soon, you know, slipping into my mind that I want to organize or set up.
That was my next question. So what's next? After the online course is launched, the Oxygen Company runs itself. What's next?
I think the first thing, because people that have now shown the books that are only available with the course, they straight away said, like, "Oh, I want that book." So now I'm thinking on actually, out of the books that I have, the two books that you get with the class, make eventually one book that will become for sale, but not for the time being. I think that I first want to see how that goes in selling that, because after that is to promote the course, you have to do a lot of writing, and then a lot of writing on what's on these days. Like, for example, there is a new gas that they use in air conditioning units, and so you can buy an air conditioning unit, but you need to know what gas is in there, because this one is a lot better than the other one. Like, you have a lot of more rendement out of it opposed to the old one, and things like that. And I think, like, and on solar energy and all this sort of stuff, where I could write about every day. So that's my idea, to put a blog and a Facebook page, and there is an enclosed community if you have booked the class, so you can people ask, "Oh, I live in that area, do you know an architect that I can trust, or a builder or something like that?" Or they can ask me questions about whatever, anything.
So are you talking about the community that will be built after you launch the the online?
Yeah,
so everybody who buys the course will be part of this community.
Yeah.
And then your next thing is to feed this community so they want to continue.
That's it.
Okay, so we have 5 to 10 minutes here to wrap up, and I wanted to ask you more general questions about your career. I always talk about mentors. So I have my mentors, and people who, basically what I call mentor is professionals that I admire.
Yeah.
And that before I make big professional decisions, I like to exchange thoughts with these people. Do you have those people in your in your professional life?
Yeah, I have several people, and from complete different, they all work, do different things. And which is better, because then you get different sort of feedbacks on it. So I got about 4 people that I sort of test these sort of things on. I give them something and they say, no, forget about this, or do that, or don't do that, or whatever. And of course, if you ask 100 people, you get 100 different opinions. But I've got people that are really
honest.
Yeah, that I think that, you know.
Are they all Dutch? Because you Dutch people are honest.
Yeah, these are they're all Dutch. In this case, they're all Dutch.
I have some Dutch friends that I love, and they are super honest. Sometimes they're actually misunderstood as rude. I love it. I prefer that people are straightforward, honest with me, because Brazilians, a lot of times, are always trying to make people happy. No. So we're not entirely honest sometimes because we want to be friendly. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my experience with my Dutch friends has been that they're very...
Yeah, and you know, they would, you can take that for rude, but you know, it helps me if people tell me, because quite often if you ask things about your business or your new business or your ideas, you ask to family, they don't want to put you down,
yeah.
And so they're gonna say, yeah, good idea, and in fact they might think like, oh god, that's shit, you know. So, and those people know that I can handle everything, so, and I listen, you know.
Right.
So
you agree that having mentors is important?
Yeah. I think that when I started off reading books. I think the first book I ever read was Rich Dad Poor Dad. I think that the second book was from Richard Branson, how he set his business up, and then from there on it went to whatever. And that actually, I've learned a lot from that. I did several courses of webinars. At that time there weren't any webinars, but with people that, you know, inspiring people. And if I get the chance here, I would do that still, if I do that still. But I think that for everybody, it's always good to sort of try your ideas on someone that you really think they're going to tell you the truth, but that also have a bit of knowledge. If they're just going to say, like, you know, that's nothing, that they have to give you a good reason why it's nothing, why wouldn't it work.
Right.
I'll give you a good example. I showed you the trailer of the masterclass.
Mm-hmm.
I did the trailer first. I sent it around to those four people. I got it back and they all said, like, ah, that's completely wrong. Everything is wrong on this thing. And they were right. Everything was wrong on it. But that gave me, by just doing it, getting it out to them, that gave me so much feedback that made me to do the thing right. But if I would have just not asked them, I would have put it online and whatever, and everyone would have said, like, why? What's this? What's this about?
It saves you so much time, right?
Eh?
It saves you so
much
time.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it does.
You
can't do everything. I tend to do everything myself, like this whole class, you know, everything that you need to do and learn. But it's always good to get other people to help you.
Mm-hmm. What about your routine? Like, do you have a performance routine? Like, you wake up at a certain hour, you have, like, we talked about why you preferred. You said that you would be in Australia if your daughters, what was it that you told me?
If we, oh yeah, they live now and they're so well here settled in Spain. So we don't want to go and live there. That's too far away from them. So.
But if they weren't in the picture, you and your wife would be in Australia.
I think we would be in Australia, yeah.
Because you said you think it's a healthier routine there.
Yeah.
People wake up earlier, they sleep earlier than in Spain.
Yeah.
And
there's more sporty. There's like, took years before you could get a juice here on the corner of the street. There was already when we were living there. And there's a lot of things. I like the attitude. You're not like here, where I never felt a foreigner here until recently. They're coming like heaps of foreigners here, like that only have holiday homes and that only are planning the next lunch or the next dinner. And they were all also my clients, right? So all good for them, but it's different. It's different to be in a big city like Sydney and still have the idea that you're like this in the park, outside, along the beach. And in Altea is not as much going on as it is over here, or in Sydney for that matter. But having said that, it's good where we live. We can, if you travel, there's no problem because you can always come home to a nice environment and then problem solved. But the routine is, my work is in the morning, my oxygen work, I do the marketing on that business. So, and my right hand is someone that lives in England, and we together work out the marketing strategy, or we got someone else too there with the three of us. And then in the afternoon, well, and then I row a couple of times in the week, and I like
to. So first you wake up and you go straight to work?
If I go.
Before you row?
No. I go to row. The rowing is early in the morning, like it's 8 o'clock start. And then by the time I'll be back, like 11 o'clock or something, 10 o'clock, 10:30, something like that, I start doing my work for the oxygen. And then you have Spanish, you have a 2 o'clock lunch, might have a siesta, and then work on the other things, whatever.
So you split your agenda, like morning is for oxygen, afternoon is for the other project.
Yeah. Well, the oxygen I monitor sort of all day long. I check the mails, things, strange things that could happen or that I could see, or that I need to reflect on or something like that. So I check the mails on that during the day. And as my right hand in England has a job, daytime job, she works in the evening. So I work with her often in the evenings now and then. But try to keep that to a minimum. So it's not like, you know, a 50-hour work week.
Right.
I try to avoid that.
And then do you sleep early, wake up early, or that doesn't make any difference in your professional life?
No, not so much. As in Spain, nothing is early. So I would wake up like 7, 8 o'clock. Depends if you go rowing, I'm 8 o'clock in the boat. But otherwise, I would get up at 8 o'clock or something like that, start working. And my part of the business is not time related. I mean, marketing, planning and writing and doing and things like that, you could do in the weekends and whenever. It doesn't matter. Where our staff will have to sit there, have to be, you know, 24 hours a day online.
How many people do you need today to make it work?
We're with six on the day-to-day business, and then there is another more or less six on that assists on software, accountancy, that sort of stuff. So we're roughly with 12, 13 people.
Okay. And everybody can work from wherever they want.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, I have so many questions here, but we're, you know, it's over an hour and I want to respect your time. So to finish, I would like to know what kinds of, I have a new group of clients now that are just leaving university. Because I'm used to working with people between 35 and 45, but now this is a new challenge for me, is working with younger people. And so imagine, you know, what suggestions would you give your 21, 22, 25-year-old self? You told me you have daughters that are
around 28 and
28. So what kind of business suggestions, career suggestions, are you giving to them?
Well, I think that the easier thing is to set a goal. That might sound easy, and it is in fact easy, but people are scared to set a goal, because goal setting is quite often thinking out of the box. If you come from school, and just straight from school, you used to, probably when I was young, you knew already that you were going to have a job like the next after the summer holiday. That was it. You could easily find a job. These days it's not the same. So you've got to work out what you like. Your goal can be something like, do you want to work with people, or can you easily enough work by yourself? Do you want to move around? Do you want to be stuck to one place? What industry are you want to work? You want to work in tourism? Might be handy to understand of knowledge of a few languages. So I think it's setting the goal, and even so, you set a short-term goal, medium, long-term goal, and work from there. And even if it doesn't really hit the goal, you know, you can always adjust and adapt to that. If you would just wait, sit and wait till it comes, it's not gonna happen. And so if your goal is simple, you wanna make money? Okay, well, put that as your goal. And if you want to make, if you want to be free, make that your goal. And then try to work from there, work backwards and find out what's needed to do that. And without the goal, I can't see it happening for none of them. And I think that everyone, my daughter is a very good one. My youngest daughter had a goal. She always said, I want to draw. I want to just illustrate. I want to illustrate. And I want to, and the best thing is she wanted to work for Disney. And that was all she wanted to do, backdrops and things in cartoon movies and what have you. And that was her goal. And although she doesn't work for Disney, she's freelance and she works on the internet. She gets all the job through the internet. That was her goal. She, before that, she did a, just to kill time because she was too young to go to live in Madrid. She studied 2 years hairdressing just to, you know, cover time, and maybe she could make some money somewhere along the line with it too.
Move and her ass, like, yeah, where we started.
And she's got something like, she doesn't only want to be working on a computer at home and not seeing anyone anymore. It's just, she's got a part-time job on the side just to make sure that she gets to, you know, get out of the house. And so that's it. If you set your goal, you want to, you really want to know where you want to go, and then it's going to work.
Yeah. I always tell the ones that are lost and they don't know what they want to do something like your daughter did, like hairdressing creates networking. English teaching creates networking. So if you're not sure what to do, go do something that will enrich your network.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
No matter what it is.
Yeah. No, it's true, true.
Yeah.
It's the same reason why we're with the GBO.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the networking, you get to know people. Like today I needed someone, and funny enough, he was sitting there three chairs down at the table.
Yeah.
That can be of help to me, you know. So that's the thing. I think that people, even after, if they go come from a school where they're used to having all sort of students around them, and then they come home and they're not there anymore, and they have to all work it out themselves, it's going to be tricky. So mm-hmm. networking is a good one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
So that is great. Do you have any last messages or thoughts for those people who are still fighting to have an inspiring career?
Yeah, I have. Don't be afraid. It's so easy to stay in within your comfort zone. And a lot of people do that. And okay, I know, there is a mortgage and there is kids and there is what have you. And it will be very difficult to make that decision. But after you've done it, you've got a different life. And especially at best is, of course, if you know really what you want to do, you've got your goal. And I don't think you should leave a company or your comfort zone before you got your goal. But as soon as you got your goal, I would put an effort in, you know, to get it up and running mm-hmm. one way or the other. And these days with the internet, there's so many things happening and on, and you don't have to have products your own to sell them. We sold equipment, oxygen equipment that wasn't ours. We had it shipped from England straight to the client. We never saw one of these units. And easy enough, you find a product that you like, a bicycle, whatever you want to sell it. You find someone that sells bicycle and you sell it for them. You know, things like that, through the internet. You don't have to go door to door. Oh, I'm selling a bicycle. Today things are far easier, but of course you have a lot more competition, so you have to be original. Try to be as original as possible. So this is the thing.
So don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid.
Be original.
Be original. The original thing is probably the tricky part. The don't be afraid. People I've seen people trying that, but there is, if you don't have to do it all in one day, you know. It's just You take some time to work it out, but plan ahead. If you don't plan anything, if you don't write your plans down, you don't make your wish list, it's not going to happen. That's it.
Okay, so then you got an extra ingredient then. Write a plan, don't be afraid, and be original.
That's it.
Great. Rutger, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
We're gonna make a 1 minute video here where we are so people can see where we are. We're, like I said, in this beautiful park. There are some guys practicing, I don't know what this is, like a workout next to us. And There are so many. One day I counted 7 different activities. I could even see esgrima. How do you say esgrima?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. With the
here
lid, yeah.
In this park. So I'm so glad that we're lucky to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Kapunkap.